The economic decline following the financial crisis of 2008 is often called the Great Recession. Joseph Stiglitz has called growing inequality the Great Divide. If Greece exits the euro, perhaps someone can come up with something better than Grexit. But the economic turmoil of our era goes far beyond these three cases, although some upheaval can actually be a good thing. In his latest book, a collection of essays drawn from his Schumpeter column in The Economist, Adrian Wooldridge, the magazine's management editor, surveys the current landscape for business, both good and bad. The Great Disruption, How Business is Coping with Turbulent Times, has been published by The Economist, and I'm very pleased it brings Adrian Wooldridge back to our show. Welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Is there something that makes this era of great disruption different from the turmoil of previous recessions or other economic shocks?
I think the pace and the nature of technological change. I think the internet and digitalization in general is an extraordinarily disruptive technology, but it's also a technology that's disrupting a broader and broader range of things. It started with the computer, but it's now going to disrupt, for example, taxi services, or, for example, with 3D printing, it will disrupt manufacturing. So that would be it, technology.
Well, you authored a book with John Micklethwaite on the history of the modern company. Isn't this era far less disruptive than the industrial upheaval 150 years ago when millions of people moved from agrarian to urban and industrial lives?
I would absolutely insist that there's nothing odd about disruption, that history has seen disruption over and over again. So Karl Marx talks about all that is solid melting into air when he's talking about the Industrial Revolution. And Joseph Schumpeter himself coined the phrase creative destruction for the 1930s during the Great Depression. But I would say now that the pace of growth, that the pace of change, the pace of disruption is unusually fast and the implications are unusually radical. What I think we're seeing now is an industrial revolution as applied to the knowledge economy, and we're only just beginning to see it.
So is it mostly the knowledge economy? What are some of the leading examples of economic or business disruption nowadays, and what's causing them?
Well, I hate to quote this example because it's a very familiar one, but it's the example of Uber, which essentially changes the nature of the company. Companies used to be sort of solid things that gave you a job, that gave you a career ladder, that gave you a sort of anchor in the world. If you go back to the year 1900, the biggest company in the United States was U.S. Steel, which employed about 250,000 people. It employed more people than the Army and Navy combined. Now, if you look like a company at a company like Uber, it basically doesn't want to employ anybody. It wants to be an algorithm which creates a spot market in talent. That's a completely new conception of what the company is. It's a virtualization.
Well, it's a lot more convenient for the company because it doesn't have to pay for health insurance and sick days or anything else. It's really just a whole, it's like freelance, a company that relies totally on freelancers.
Well, I think we're entering into a phase now of what I call the capitalism of zero. Companies basically don't want to have any assets and they don't want to have any employees. They want to be completely freed of these things. They want to become as virtual as possible. But even if you don't use that very advanced sort of contract model that Uber and the rest of the freelance economy use, even if you look at a company like Google, which has employees, or Facebook, which has employees, they're still very small. Google, I think, has about 50,000 employees. Again, as I said, US Steel, 250,000. The big companies, I mean, the driving, organizing companies of our time are much, much smaller in terms of the number of people that they employ than the companies of previous eras.
Do disruptive influences make the environment less certain or predictable for
businesses?
Massively
so. Massively so. I think we live in an era in which business is itself much less predictable than it ever has been before, in which technology is disrupting things, in which business has to be essentially very, very conservative in terms of employing people and making in terms of making plans, because the environment, just the business environment, is uncertain. And then on top of that, the economic environment that we're in, because of all sorts of things going on, not least Greece, is also extremely uncertain.
But doesn't human nature make people wary of disruption, even
Absolutely.
When it might have a good effect?
Absolutely. I think that it's an extremely difficult environment for people to be in, and one of the reasons why you see so many opinion polls suggesting that people aren't optimistic about the future or worried about the future, live in a sort of perpetual state of anxiety, is because we're getting disruption. But I always think that if I move house, that's disruptive, but I'm happy to move house if I get a bigger, better house in a nicer place. If I change my job, that's disruptive, but I'm happy to do that if I get better conditions, more pay. What's happening in the world at the moment for vast numbers of people is you're being disrupted, you're moving house, you're changing your job, but you're not getting any better. It's combined stagnation with disruption,
although
in ways that are very bad.
Although sometimes it just takes years to see how things will turn out.
I think that that's true, but and what we're seeing at the moment is a paradox. We're seeing an extraordinary growth in productivity in certain areas, so we're seeing an extravagance of affluence, of opportunity. If I look at my iPad, I can get endless books, endless things, many of them for free, which I couldn't have got at all a few years ago. So that's affluence. On the other hand, if I look at my wages, my salary, and most of us look at our salary, they're not going up at anything like the sort of pace that they would have been in the past.
My guest is Adrian Wooldridge, whose latest book is a collection of her Schumpeter columns for The Economist. The book is The Great Disruption, How Business is Coping with Turbulent Times, published by The Economist. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You mentioned polls. Well, Gallup reports that Americans currently rank the economy, dissatisfaction with government, healthcare, immigration, and education as their top concerns, but they don't mention disruption.
Well, I think when people are talking about the economy, disruption is sort of there in the background of their minds. I think everybody is under the impression that life is changing. They're having to adjust to new things with great speed, but also that their wages aren't sort of zooming up, that they're quite often stagnant. So I think it's a way of describing a discontent which is economically rooted.
You mentioned Greece. It's holding a referendum on whether to exit from the euro later this week, and polls suggest that they want to remain in the euro. How disruptive have the divisions over Greece's debt been?
Well, I would regard Greece as a huge disruption in the short term. And this week, you know, in Greece, of course, the banks are closed. The markets tumbled yesterday. They've gone up a bit today. But I would regard Greece more generally as more of a distraction than a big disruption, because it's a very small economy. It's a very small part of the eurozone. And it's required people to spend an inordinate amount of attention just looking at this small thing. Europe has huge problems, which are much bigger than just the problem of Greece. That has problems of immigration, large numbers of people on the borders trying to get in. And Europe has a much bigger problem than that, and that is something that's not confined to Greece, right across the continent, which is a sort of a fear of change, which is sort of paralyzing it.
Greece has 11 million people and a GDP of about $240 billion. Well, New York City's product is estimated to be over $1 trillion. But stock markets around the world have dropped as a result of this crisis.
Well,
it's not all that important, has there been that kind of response?
Two responses to that. One is that stock markets always overreact. And I think today the stock market has gone back up. It hasn't. Asia's gone back up. And I think the rest of the world is going back up as a result of that. And I think because people have factored in to their thinking that even if Greece leaves the euro in some way, that there are enough defenses in place that it won't be a huge contagion.
Puerto Rico's governor, Alejandro Garcia Padilla, has said that his island's debt is not payable, and Puerto Rico uses the dollar. What kind of upheaval could that cause through the rest of the United States?
Well, I think it's, you know, this could be America's Greece and will have exactly the same sort of impact as Greece does, that it's not a big enough economy really to shake things up, but it does take a huge amount of attention and does create a lot of uncertainty in what is already a very, very uncertain world.
Well, there have been a number of arguments about the euro and the eurozone. Some people argue that it never should have even been put together because the economies of these countries are all so different. They have different central banking systems and the like. Others are pointing out that if Greece leaves, that's going to be an invitation to other countries to leave as well, and then the whole thing is just going to fall apart.
Well, I don't think it will fall apart, and I think if Greece leaves, it will probably be an invitation for other countries to put their houses in order, because I think the chaos will be so great and the suffering for the Greeks will be so significant that people will not want to leave. I think the problem is that Greece should never have been admitted to the eurozone in the first place. It's not a strong enough economy. It's not really a modern country in all
sorts
of ways.
And it even lied a bit about its
financial situation. And they absolutely
lied
about it. And people only believe their lies because they wanted to believe it, because any forensic accounting of those books would have gone out. But Greece, you know, it's the foundation of modern civilization, modern democracy. So They bent over backwards for that. They shouldn't have done that. The euro should have been restricted to much, much stronger currencies. And even now, I think that we're going to have a big reassessment of the pace of expansion of the European Union. It's expanding too quickly. It's bringing in too many peripheral countries which don't have strong enough economies. And Greece is an example that perhaps we should be consolidating rather than expanding.
Well, it's a political thing. There's a reason why some countries would like to see Ukraine join the eurozone.
Yes, I think it would be a terrible mistake to admit them to the eurozone.
Another troubled economy.
Yeah, another troubled economy and a very weak economy. But of course, there are geopolitical reasons to do that. But there's one thing admitting a country to a free trading zone, another admitting it to a currency zone. And currency zones should be much more careful in their expansion. But there is, you know, the mention of Ukraine raises one of the bigger problems with Greece, which is if Greece becomes a failed state in Europe, if it is ejected from the eurozone, there is a real problem that it will move towards the Soviet, towards the Russian camp, to Mr. Putin's camp, quasi-Soviet, I suppose I'd call it.
Far more serious turbulence is tearing apart Syria and Iraq. Mm-hmm. Can economic upheavals cause as much disruption as wars?
No, because I think that wars bring in their wake economic disruption, economic upheaval. But I think the great disruption, which I talk about in this book, and the sort of things that are going on in the broader Middle East, are not entirely separated from each other. Because I think when you have an economy which is, as Schumpeter said, which proceeds through a process of creative destruction, gales of creative destruction, I think it creates a great deal of uncertainty in people's minds. And some people respond to that uncertainty by going back to ethnic and religious identities.
Isn't international trade seen as a stabilizing influence? Doesn't globalization amount actually to more international trade?
I think,
but you describe it as one of the forces causing disruption.
Well, I think an economist would say that globalization, free trade, produces wealthier societies. It creates more wealth in the long term, but it creates more wealth, again, in Schumpeterian terms, through creative destruction. You can't have the creation without having the destruction, and that creates uncertainty. And I would say that it's not just a matter of economics, not just a matter of comparative advantage. It is a matter of a pace of change, which some people react to by retreating into identities. Sometimes it may be a good thing. You know, you cling to your culture because it gives you a sense of meaning. But sometimes if that culture is radical Islam, then that's not a very good thing.
Some historians attribute turmoil in the Middle East to past interference from European powers like Britain. Can innovation in one place have negative effects elsewhere? Britain growing at the expense of India or the Middle East, for example?
Sure, absolutely it can. Britain and the Western powers in general are hugely implicated in the long-term origins of the instability and weirdness, frankly, in the Middle East. The nation states that they created there out of very tribal societies were odd, artificial constructions. Nevertheless, I think that one of the better, I'm quite pessimistic in this book in all sorts of ways, but one of the better things that's happening in the world at the moment is we have much more balanced growth, in that we have growth in the emerging world, particularly in Asia, rather than not at the expense of the rich world. We have a more balanced global economy. The global economy after the Second World War was dominated by the United States. Then we get Europe growing and becoming an important pillar of it, and now we have growth in China and the emerging world in general. So it's the prosperity, opportunity is more evenly distributed around the world now than it has ever been in history, I should think.
And yet you wrote in a recent Schumpeter column for The Economist, Western companies face a growing risk of blowback from their behavior in the Middle East. He also wrote, it can be hard to square the requirements of U.S. or Western laws with Middle Eastern traditions of agreeing on deals informally. So there are other factors like the cultures of business that we have to consider?
Absolutely. I think that when businesses operate in foreign countries, they have all sorts of risks. And one of those risks is that they may be tempted to operate according to principles of, let's say, informal agreements, which might be contrary to the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act or things like that. Companies, Western companies, are being held to very, very high standards in their conduct abroad now. And the willingness of the American government and European governments, particularly British governments, to prosecute companies that step out of line is very high. So you have to be very careful. On the one hand, you have to be sensitive to local cultures. On the other hand, you don't need to take bribes.
Can something be seen as innovative in one region but wrong or even criminal in another?
Oh, absolutely. Many, many business practices are innovative. One person's flexibility is another person's bribe, frankly. And we have to be very, very careful. Companies have to be very careful about that. And they've got into huge trouble in China and in the Middle East over adapting too much to local practices.
My guest is Adrian Wooldridge, the Economist Management Editor, author of the Schumpeter Column, previously based in Washington, D.C. as the Washington Bureau Chief, where he also wrote the Lexington Column and served as the Economist West Coast correspondent, management correspondent, and U.K. correspondent. His latest book, The Great Disruption, How Business is Coping with Turbulent Times, it's published by The Economist. We will continue our conversation after this. And we are back with Adrian Wooldridge. His latest book is a collection of his Schumpeter columns from The Economist called The Great Disruption, How Business is Coping with Turbulent Times. It's published by The Economist. In the introduction to your book, you call this the age of Schumpeter. So let's talk about Joseph Schumpeter.
Yeah.
What are the central features of his thinking?
Well, Joseph Schumpeter was a remarkable economist. He was a sort of technophobe, technophile. He loved technology. He thought technology was changing the world for the better and all sorts of things, but he also refused to do anything with it. He didn't like it. So he was a professor at Harvard University. He only once went on the underground train, the subway that goes to Cambridge, that goes to Boston from Cambridge. He didn't like to fly. He didn't drive. He didn't like sort of photocopiers and things like that.
He probably wouldn't have a cell phone today.
He wouldn't have a cell phone today. So he was a bit of a fuddy-duddy. He spent an hour a day, every day, dressing himself. He once said to his great rival, John Maynard Keynes, that he wanted to be the world's greatest horseman, the world's greatest lover, and the world's greatest economist, and that he'd achieved two of his three ambitions, which didn't please Keynes very much. But he was an economist who believed in two things, which is why we decided The Economist to call this column Schumpeter. One was that the other possibility was actually Wilson, after James Wilson, who was the founder of The Economist. But he believed that the businessman really matters. He believes that businessmen were sort of heroes, that they were people who conceived of a future and brought a future into being. So he actually was an economist who liked businessmen, which is not true of all economists. And secondly, he had this notion of creative destruction, which we've talked about before, that for capitalism to create the future, to change things, it also has to destroy things.
Disruptive innovation.
Which is disruptive innovation in the new sort of Clay Christensen version.
Now, Clayton Christensen wrote about disruptive innovation in the 1990s. As a follow-up, what did he observe?
Well, his is a very specific theory as a follow-up. And what he argues is that a lot of the best ideas come, as it were, from the bottom of society. Not from the bottom of society, from the bottom of a business. They're sort of clever, new ideas for doing things more cheaply, more effectively, and that for a long time they get dismissed by the CEO, who says, no, we can't do that. We'll just stick with our customers. We'll stick with our regular business model. And gradually, these things that look peripheral to companies get better and better and better and better until finally they take things over. And one possibility at the moment would be that MOOCs, these online university courses, they look a bit threadbare at the moment. They'll get better and better and better, and eventually they'll displace universities as the best way of teaching people higher education. So it's innovations that come from nowhere and suddenly take over and displace other businesses.
Isn't one of the problems that real disruption and innovation is unpredictable? Can you plan discovery or technological revolution?
Well, you have to plan. You do plan discovery in the sense that, you know, a lot of discoveries take a lot of thought, a lot of investment, and a lot of long-term thinking, but you can't plan which ones are going to take on. So the market is coming from all over the place. There are different companies doing different things, and suddenly somebody will come from nowhere to take things out. Now, I think we know that we're seeing a period in which these on-demand companies have got a technology, a way of linking workers together and doing things more efficiently and more cheaply. And we're going to see a lot of activity in that region. There's no doubt that we will. Which particular company will survive is more difficult to predict.
When Arthur C. Clarke devised 2001, he had no idea that the microchip would be developed. So HAL is this huge computer where he would have actually in 2001 have been the size of a cell phone.
One of the things that worries me about doing this, writing this column, is whenever I look at these science fiction writers, which are which is a sort of rather snooty child I dismissed as being silly. When I look at them, they're actually over and over again, they've got the future right, you know, whether it's Star Trek or Arthur C. Clarke. That amazing ability to see the future.
Can disruption like the financial crisis of 2007 be attributed to innovation? I'm thinking about, for example, not positive things, but the subprime mortgages and other financial tools behind the housing bubble. Were they good things in any way?
They were definitely innovations, and the financial services industry is an extraordinarily innovative industry. And they were saying at that time that they had these ways of packaging risk, which would spread risk and make it less risky, as it were. It was a better way of managing risk. And of course, it turned out not to be the case in a major way. But no, there's all sorts of innovations going on constantly in the financial services industry. And now we have, of course, crowdfunding and all sorts of other things.
So, what about high-frequency trading, another Wall Street innovation?
I would say that is an innovation. It's an innovation that depends on, you know, technological breaks. It makes me very uncomfortable, the sheer volume of money and the speed of things. And if, you know, if it goes in the wrong direction, you know, as it has in the past, you know, suddenly things fall apart very quickly till you have a circuit breaker or something like that. So you have to make sure when you're doing these sort of things that you install all sorts of circuit breakers. And it's quite often that the innovators work much more quickly than the people who regulate them. And I think one of the things that you tend to see in the capitalist economy is that talent goes to the least regulated areas. You know, so now that we're seeing these big banks increasingly regulated like utilities, talent's migrating to hedge funds and from hedge funds somewhere else. So always the cleverest people are going for the areas where you can get the maximum upturn.
You referred to anti-capitalists a few times. Who are they in your view?
Anti-capitalists. Well, there are various degrees of anti-capitalists. I would say that the Tsipras people in Greece are left-wing socialists. They don't like capitalism very much. I would say that the French mindset is something that's very skeptical about the Anglo-Saxon version of capitalism. So there are degrees all the way from socialist workers who hate capitalism per se to people who think that the Anglo-Saxon free market version is bad and we need more market regulation, more government guidance. I would say that the sort of the really coherent anti-capitalists of the sort that we saw with Marx have tended to fade into the past. Everybody's made some sort of compromise with capitalism. It's a matter of how much of a compromise.
So are you saying people who call for more regulation are anti-capitalists?
No, definitely not. In fact, I would say, and as I said in the previous book that John Micklethwaite and I wrote, The Fourth Revolution, is that it's absolutely vital to have a powerful, well-run state which regulates large areas of the economy, like the financial services industry, in order for capitalism to work.
Because have you told the Supreme Court that?
I would never deign to tell the Supreme Court what to think. I personally think that some of their decisions about the right of corporations to speak politically, to interfere in, not to interfere, to express themselves in the political processes are very wrong. But I think that regulation, very few people would say that we should have no regulation. It's always a matter of what degree of regulation that we should have. But the financial services industry is clearly something that has a huge potential for creating anarchy if it's not properly adjusted, regulated.
You call the TV show Breaking Bad a first-rate primer on business.
Absolutely. But
Walter White, the protagonist of the series, gets into the drug business out of sheer desperation.
He gets in because he has to pay his healthcare costs, which are extremely extremely large. But he's a brilliant entrepreneur. I mean, and he is in many ways a Schumpeterian entrepreneur in the sense that Schumpeter thought that entrepreneurs were people who had visions of the future and who were sort of slightly crazy. They could see a world that they wanted to bring about, and then they would do anything to bring that world around about. And as we see in Breaking Bad, he starts off sort of dipping his toe in it, and ultimately he becomes consumed by this vision of a company that's bigger than what was it, General Motors or General Electric, I can't remember which, a huge business, and he'll do anything to bring that business into existence. I think that's quite often the case with entrepreneurs. It's also the case, interestingly, that the town of Albuquerque, I think it's in Albuquerque, which is also where Microsoft started its business.
Well, it's interesting also that there are some technological innovations that come just out of raw curiosity rather than necessity or scarcity, like Steve Jobs working in his garage. But don't many conservatives argue for cutting social programs like unemployment insurance on the grounds that need will prompt people to seek work more aggressively?
Many conservatives do argue that. I think it's a delicate balancing act. In some ways, if you have a functioning social security system, people will actually be more mobile because, you know, one of the problems at the moment that you have in the United States is job lock, that people are unwilling to take a risk and to start their own company or to move from one company to another because they're locked into their healthcare, which is tied to companies. So I think it can be argued both ways.
Just yesterday, envoys of governments that plan to join a Chinese-led Asian bank endorsed a structure that gives Beijing the biggest voting stake in at the start, although no veto power. Britain and Australia signed on despite U.S. and Japanese opposition. I'm thinking about politics and economics because in Asia, China is growing economically and militarily, and China, Japan, and the Philippines have disputes over islands. So how closely are business and political disruption?
Oh, they're hugely close, and also the political and business disruption are both things that require very careful management. I mean, what you're talking about with China there, I think the rise of China is as equally important and equally difficult as the rise of Germany was in the 19th century, in the late 19th century. And we need to manage it much better than we managed the rise of Germany. And one of the things that we're seeing with this bank that the Chinese are setting up is an example of incredibly bad management, because we might massively have reduced the incentives of the Chinese to start this bank if it was the case, for example, that we didn't. The IMF and the World Bank at the moment are divided between, as far as I can see, the French, who always get to run the IMF, and the Americans, who get to run the World Bank. Now, that's a crazy system in a global world.
Is that why Britain has joined in on the Chinese bank despite American opposition?
Britain has joined in because Britain sees China as a very important country. And although we're very pro-American, we want to be in with the Chinese as well. And that's in our interest. But the Americans have handled that issue, this issue of the bank, extremely badly. And you need, on the one hand, to accept that the Chinese are going to try and create instruments for lending in their own broader region, but secondly, reform the Bretton Woods institutions so that the emerging countries have much more say over them. You know, France is an important and wonderful country, but, you know, in a world with big emerging markets, it shouldn't be allowed to keep control of the IMF.
I'm wondering about India, which does not have as good an economy as you'd imagine, considering the fact that Amartya Sen, Avinash Dixit, Jagdish Bhagwati are all noted Indian economists. Raghuram Rajan went from teaching at the University of Chicago to governing the Reserve Bank of India. So India has a lot of great thinkers, and yet it's struggling.
Well, it's also the case that if you look at management gurus and the management sciences, you know, a vast number of these management gurus are Indian. And I think that probably the single biggest nationality, apart from US, in American business schools, running the business schools, are Indians. There are lots of Indians running business schools, including Harvard Business School. So there's a huge management expertise. And if you go to India, you think, yeah, it's not as well managed as it ought to be. Actually, India is now growing more rapidly than China. It's going through quite a good patch at the moment. But, of course, there are huge problems. It's a very varied economy. They've got some fantastic companies like Tata and like Mahindra and Mahindra, really, really good companies. But, you know, if you look at the average, you know, corner store,
Farmers are struggling.
They're terrible, and the farming industry is very bad. I actually think that the farming industry would be hugely improved if some big Western retail companies, which are very good at things like supply chain management, were allowed to move into those countries. Because what you see is, you know, 40-50% of products just rotting before they reach the shops, because the farmers just have no way of managing the supply chain very well.
We're pretty much out of time, but I want to quote Schumpeter from Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy. He wrote of a perennial gale of creative destruction and a process of industrial mutation that incessantly revolutionizes the economic structure from within, incessantly destroying the old one, incessantly creating a new one. Is that a sustainable process?
Well, Schumpeter's own belief was that it goes through a process of crises, and that some of these crises were quite big. So during the Great Depression, he actually thought, well, in many ways, depression is one of the things you prices that you have to pay. I think it is a sustainable process, but we need to have a certain amount of management to make sure that we're not blown over by the gale.
Isn't it better to have a steady state?
I think a steady state tends to lead to stagnation and decline. Trouble is, you can't just stay where you are. You have to go forward, or you'll end up going backwards.
Adrian Wooldridge, his latest book is The Great Disruption, How Business is Coping with Turbulent Times. The book is published by The Economist. And I want to thank you for coming by our show once again.
Thank you very much.
It's always fascinating talking with you.
Thank you.